Our first case is 10-1561, Daryl Sampson versus Cuyahoga Metropolitan Housing Authority et al. For the appellants, Stephen Funk.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Stephen Funk of Retzel and Andrus on behalf of the appellant, CMHA. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal. This appeal asks this court to decide the meaning and scope of revised code 2744.09B and whether it should be construed to apply to intentional tort claims brought by public employees against public political subdivisions. Now, the key language here is the phrase arises out of the employment relationship. And I submit that that phrase is not new, that it was not created by the General Assembly, that it comes straight from this court's opinion in the Blankenship case, which was decided in 1982, 3 years before the immunity statute was adopted. And in that case, this court clearly held that intentional torts, by definition, do not arise out of the employment relationship. So when the General Assembly enacted 2744.09B, it would have been aware of that fact, and using the language arising out of the employment relationship, would have understood that that would not include intentional torts. In fact, I think that it's wholly inconsistent with the intent and purpose of the immunity statute to construe it as applying to intentional tort claims. The entire purpose of the statute is to protect the public fisc, to ensure that political subdivisions are not the insurers of alleged tort liabilities, except in very specific circumstances. And most of the circumstances spelled out in the statute deal with negligence, and they're very, very well defined. And there's no indication in the statute that the General Assembly intended to open the door to intentional torts, particularly torts that relate to the exercise of law enforcement powers, such as false arrest, malicious prosecution claims, which essentially are not claims that would fall within any conception of what the General Assembly wanted to hold political subdivisions liable for.
Well, what is the tort that you're involved with here, Mr. Funk?
There are three claims that are alleged. The claims are intentional infliction of emotional distress.
Is that an intentional tort?
Yes.
All right.
Abusive process.
Is that intentional?
Yes. And the third one is a claim that's been identified as being a negligent misidentification claim. But if you read the complaint, it specifically alleges intentional conduct. It's essentially the equivalent of a false arrest claim. What they're alleging here is all three of these claims relate to the arrest of Mr. Sampson as a result of a criminal investigation.
Well, he was arrested for allegedly improperly using a gasoline card in connection with his work as a plumber for the Cleveland Metropolitan Housing Authority. Is that about it?
That's correct.
But he was subsequently indicted by a grand jury for that offense, was he not?
He was, yes.
What's the impact of an indictment by the grand jury?
Well, the grand jury found that there had been probable cause for the arrest, and I think that on the merits certainly is going to affect that negligent misidentification claim. But ultimately, when we're talking about immunity, with respect to all three of these claims, none of these claims are based upon the employment relationship.
Well, certainly, Mr. Funk, they are, because he was told to come to an employment meeting. He was arrested in front of his coworkers. And wasn't there a subsequent investigation that found that the investigation leading to his arrest was slipshod at best, that it had not been thorough?
Well, again, the three claims that he's alleged here, though, are not based upon any terms or conditions of his employment. What we're talking about here are common law injuries that he's alleging that arose from his arrest. Mm-hmm. And in that regard, the intentional claims that he's alleging against the political subdivision is like any other tort claim that would result from an arrest or an investigation that you claim.
But counsel, but for his position with this employer, there would not have been a claim for abuse of process, intentional infliction of emotional distress, false arrest, etc. There couldn't have been. They didn't go outside of their employees to conduct this investigation, they didn't bring people off the street into the employees' meeting, and they didn't handcuff anybody other than employees.
Right, Your Honor, and I would submit that that's essentially what the 8th District ultimately was focused on, which is that the acts were committed at the workplace. But as this court held—
Against employees. Not just at the workplace.
Right, against employees. But in this court held in Brady, the fact that common law injuries are incurred at the workplace as a result of actions of the employer does not mean that it arises out of the employment relationship.
Did the use of the gas card arise out of the employment relationship?
The claims that he's alleging, which are based upon alleged tort injuries, do not arise out of the employment relationship.
Did the use of the gas card arise out of the employment relationship?
The use of the gas card was committed by him, by the plaintiff, as part of his job duties, but that doesn't mean that his claims, his civil actions, arise from the employment relationship. And
As ultimately turns out, he never did anything wrong with the gas card.
Well, that's a question ultimately that will have to be decided at
hasn't
trial.
Hasn't it been decided? The indictment has been dismissed. There's no criminal prosecution. Isn't that right?
That is correct. But
so he was arrested, indicted, and then that indictment is gone. So
right.
Wouldn't we not conclude that the use of the gas card was in connection with the employment relationship?
I would say no, because what we're looking at...
Well, he spent 24 hours in jail.
Right. What we're looking at, though, Your Honor, is the nature of the claims that have been alleged against the political subdivision. Here we have intentional tort claims that allege that the political subdivision intentionally inflicted emotional distress. So we're looking at the actions of the defendant, not the actions of the plaintiff. The allegations against the defendant involve intentional misconduct. And those types of allegations, by definition, do not arise out of the employment relationship. That's what this court has long held. And that is a bright line standard that has long been applied. And then you look at the nature of the rights that are being sought to be prosecuted here. These are common law tort injuries. So he's essentially bringing claims in his capacity as a tort victim against an intentional tortfeasor. And in that capacity, it's like any other tort action that would be brought against the political subdivision. Should be subject to the same immunity standards that would apply to any other tort case.
Well, were they negligent in arresting him?
Your Honor, I would submit that that claim, if you look at the allegations of the complaint, that's the fourth claim in the complaint, it alleges intentional misconduct and essentially alleges that there was
the act of arresting someone is sort of an intentional act, but
right.
My question is, were they negligent in doing so because he obviously hadn't misused the credit card? So is that a negligence claim?
In that case, it's an issue of whether they had probable cause to arrest. And as you've indicated earlier, the grand jury did indict him. So that is an indication that they did have probable cause to arrest him. And ultimately, if they had there wasn't really a misidentification. He clearly used the card. He was the person that was the subject of the investigation. The question only related, did they have probable cause to arrest him?
If we rule in your favor and find that this does not arise out of the employment, but the plaintiff is able to establish that these torts were actually committed, does he have remedy against anybody? Does he have remedy against individually the persons in the government unit that caused these decisions to be made? What is he left with?
Yeah, there are three defendants in this case that have been alleged individual claims against those individual defendants. This court did not accept review of those claims. They are, therefore, would continue in the ordinary course. The 8th District found that there was no immunity for those three claims and sent it back for trial. And I think that the structure of the statute contemplates that if there's intentional misconduct, now the individual employees are subject to their own immunity standards under 2744.03A6, and those standards would apply to those claims. But to the extent that there is a claim under those standards, 2744.07 says that the political subdivision is not the party to be paying those claims. There's no indemnification for those claims. So, by definition, the statute itself contemplates that the political subdivisions are not supposed to be the insurers of intentional tort claims.
Counsel, the idea that you first expressed about intentional tort being totally separate from the employment relationship, didn't that arise in the cases talking about workers' comp and the idea of, you know, what is an intentional tort, what is covered by the employment relationship and therefore workers' comp? Is it necessary for us to engraft that principle on this type of case that relates to immunity, totally a different idea?
Well, I think It isn't totally a different idea, but to answer your question, I think that what the court should be focused on is what did the General Assembly mean when it used the phrase arising out of the employment relationship? And when it adopted that language, the General Assembly would have been aware of the common law definition of intentional torts.
But it could have also looked at it in terms of those cases being related to workers' comp and not to a general view of what would be immunity or covered by immunity or not covered by immunity.
But the reasoning of those cases deal with the common law definition of intentional tort, that an intentional tort, by definition, by its common law nature, does not arise out of the employment relationship.
Doesn't that come from the Brady case, and wasn't that a splintered opinion?
It originated in Blankenship. Brady, I think, was 1991. And yes, there were dissents, but I would submit that the General Assembly, when they used that phrase, arising out of the employment relationship, would have been cognizant of the fact that that does not conclude intentional tort.
It seems that we have been retreating from that. If you look at Kaminsky then, we also talked about this whole idea of the dichotomy between intentional tort and workers' comp.
Right.
That's my stumbling block, the very first statement that you made here, because it appears that is your strongest argument that you're making to the court.
Right. I think that you have to look at the fact that it was the common law understanding of intentional torts. And it wasn't just based upon workers' comp. In other words, what the courts essentially said was that when you intentionally harm an employee, that is not conduct that arises out of the employment relationship. So it didn't turn on the language of the workers' comp statute or the purposes. It turned on the common law conception of what.
But wasn't the content of those cases dealing with when an employer does something to the work environment that intentionally causes, and it's interpreted as intentional, and that act of maybe removing safety equipment or not requiring it or whatever the situation might be, that's the parameters of the employer's activity that is addressed in those cases, is it not?
Yeah, and I think what it says is that the employer, when you have an injury resulting from an employer intentional misconduct, that is not the normal hazard of employment. The same thing here, where you've got an allegation that there's been a false arrest, that is not a typical injury that occurs during employment. It's not a natural hazard of employment. It arises outside the scope of employment. It arises from the fact that there's an alleged intentional tort that is not related to employment, but it related to arrest and investigation for a crime. And so when you look at the legal remedy for that tort,
isn't your better argument that yeah, it did arise out of employment, but it's beyond the contract between employer and employee? Instead of, continuously saying this didn't arise out of employment, I don't think there's too many people up here that don't agree or can't see it as part of your employment activity. Your argument is that it's out of the normal scope and activity of a employer-employee relationship, just like an intentional tort in the workplace for removal of safety equipment, et cetera, is not a bargained-for relationship.
Right. I think it's both, Your Honor. I think that the fact that when we talk about employment relationship, so the fact that not that it didn't occur at the workplace or that it didn't involve employment in some capacity. What we're talking about, though, is the tort injury itself was not related to a term or condition of employment. It was not seeking to enforce an employment-based right that was created or depended upon the employment relationship. It's seeking to bring a normal tort claim based upon a tort injury that's not related to employment.
All right, let me ask you then, one of the other considerations here is that these people were arrested in front of their coworkers. They did, the perp walk with the police and arrested and photographed, et cetera. And the statement was made by the employers, this will be an example that employees can't steal from the employer here. How does that put a different twist on your argument?
Well, I think that, first of all, there was a disputed testimony about whether that was said or not, but assuming that it was said, I don't think it affects it at all, because ultimately what we're talking about here again is, are the claims based upon or arising out of the employment relationship. In other words, that claim is still an intentional infliction of emotional distress claim, which is a tort injury that is not, that's totally unrelated to employment. It's related on an alleged tort injury that should be treated no differently than any other tort claim.
Counsel, and that brings me to my question. Is there a difference between a matter that arises out of employment and a matter that arises out of the employment relationship? Are those two, is there a distinction between those two?
I think that there is. I think that's a fundamental, I think that's a good point in terms of there's a concept of the course of employment. So during the course of employment, I as an employee may take certain action. There's a separate concept when we're talking about the employment relationship. So when you have an intentional tort claim, it doesn't rise out of the employment relationship because it's not based upon a claim that would be created or dependent upon an employment relationship, like an employment discrimination claim. And this court has held employment discrimination claims fall within the scope of 2744.09B. And the reason for that is because that's a right that's created and dependent upon the employment relationship. It arises out of the employment relationship. A tort injury is unrelated to the fact of employment. Yes, it occurs at the workplace, but it's not an injury that is based upon the employment relationship.
Except, Mr. Funk, here, doesn't CMHA have their own police department? Wasn't this all done? So it was CMHA's investigation, CMHA's police department. Everything that surrounds this is because of the employment relationship.
Every political subdivision, Your Honor, has a police department that will be involved in investigating crimes within their jurisdiction. So yes,
but not as closely connected as the CMHA relationship.
But I would submit, Your Honor, that you have to look at the nature of the claim that's being alleged. So their claim is not based upon a termination action or an adverse employment action. The claim is based upon the exercise of law enforcement powers with respect to false arrest and criminal investigation. And it's that nature of it that actually takes it out of the employment relationship because it's not based upon any rights or benefits granted by the employment relationship. It's based upon common law tort injuries that arose from an investigation and arrest for criminal activity. And that should be treated like any other tort claim.
Mr. Funk, your red light's on, but I don't want to take this out of your limited rebuttal time. Rarely do we see briefs in which the recitation of facts are so diametrically opposed. Both of you cite to the record. So what's going on here? Is somebody stretching the truth, or how do you explain that? In terms of the explanation of what occurred that morning when they were summoned and presented and arrested, two totally different stories.
I think the facts,
we don't see that very often in briefs.
Well, I think you had affidavits and depositions that there were conflicts. And I don't know that either party is stretching the truth at all.
The Court of Appeals must have, their recitation of facts more nearly tracks the appellee's statement of facts.
I think they construed the facts in the light most favorable to the appellee. But I think that ultimately the question before the court now really turns on looking at the nature of the claims alleged in the complaint. So look at the
complaint.
Well,
let me ask you a direct question. Were these people called out in front of all 200 people or not?
Your Honor, I can go by the testimony of the witnesses, and there was testimony that says that they were called out, but that there wasn't the comments that have been discussed here today.
Well, so, your brief says they were put over in a side room where nobody saw it and nobody saw it happen.
Right, they were called, taken to a side room where they were arrested and outside the view of other employees. Ultimately, though, the claims that have been alleged here, though, are intentional torts, intentional infliction of emotional distress.
I understand the legal. I'm just asking about these gross differences in statement of facts. We don't see that often, and it's troubling to me when we see that in briefs.
Yeah, and I would submit that the court really here is taking on the legal question of what is the meaning of 2744.09b. And I guess I would ask this court to make two holdings. One is to reaffirm that intentional torts, by definition, do not arise out of the employment relationship. And two, that 2744.09b is really based upon claims that are created by or dependent upon the employment relationship, as opposed to common law tort claims that
Counsel,
are not.
Counsel, thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Schuster?
Good morning, Chief Justice and members of the court. I'm Nancy Schuster. I represent Daryl Sampson, the appellee.
Ma'am, could you speak up and maybe into the microphone? Thank you.
Usually I speak too loudly, which I'm trying to avoid. Is that better?
That's great. Thank you.
Thank you. To argue, as CMHA does, that this matter did not arise out of Mr. Sampson's employment relationship with his political subdivision employer requires the application of a fiction to twist the meaning of government immunity by applying what I believe is a misstatement of the Blankenship Jones line of cases. Let me begin by saying that the essential facts are as the court has mentioned them. And I should mention, in addition to the facts that the court has mentioned, that this arrest, which did take place in front of 200 fellow employees, was not a proper arrest in the first place, since Rule 4 of the criminal rules, as the court knows, require the body to summons people who are likely to appear.
Counsel, if I might get to the question that's
yes.
directly on my mind, is there a difference between a matter that arises out of one's employment arises out of one's employment relationship?
If there is, I can't imagine what it might be.
What about wrongful discharge?
I think wrongful discharge would arise out of the employment relation. The wrongful discharge would be the result of things which happened during the employment relation between the employee and the employer.
Right. Well, what about not maintaining the safety guards on a machine?
Do you mean when an employer would be alleged to do that?
Yes.
You know, my answer to you on that has to be that that's a different issue. And what's happening here is that CMHA is conflating a body of law which applies to workers' compensation and the workers' compensation statute with a body of law which applies to governmental immunity. Those are two different immunities. And you don't need to, and shouldn't import language from the one immunity into the other immunity. So I can't answer your question about removing the guard on a piece of equipment. This is not a workers' comp case, with all due respect, and has no relationship to workers' comp.
Counsel, your opponent says that it's a matter of common law rather than statutory interpretation that we're talking about here. So if we look at it in that perspective, would the outcome be different?
I don't think so. And the reason I don't think so is because of the words of 2744.09 and 09B. 09 starts, "This chapter does not apply to and shall not be construed to apply to civil actions by an employee against his political subdivision relative to what? Relative to any matter that arises out of the employment relation between them. It is not necessary to go back and look at workers' compensation, which has no relationship, to find some reason to make the words that arises out of the employment relation between them not understandable.
What if two employees get into a verbal argument and then one of them punches the other? Does that arise out of the employment relationship, or does that arise out of the employment? And is there a difference?
I can't say, but I can say that this particular case arose out of the employment relation. The only individuals involved in this case are Mr. Sampson as the employee, the director of CMHA, the chief of police of CMHA, and a lieutenant in their police department. An entity can only act through somebody, and the somebodies that CMHA acts through or acted through were the director and the chief of police. So this is a relationship, a culmination of a relationship between this employee and that employer, and I don't see how any other spin can be put on it. I also would like to ask the court, if you were the legislature and you wanted to write something that said this applies to anything that happens out of the employment relationship, how else would you write it? If you were writing a release and you wanted to release claims that occurred during the employment relationship, that's how you would write it. It's not a term of art that was suddenly invented by Blankenship, Brady, and Jones. I would also like to mention that Blankenship, Brady, and Jones themselves, as this court recognized in Penn Traffic, said that, in fact, this is a fiction because these cases couldn't be workers' compensation cases if they didn't arise out of the employment relationship. So we're importing a legal fiction to clear up an ambiguity that is clearly not present. There is no ambiguity to clear up. In the words of Justice Speer in 1902, we should not attempt to exercise the power of introducing doubt and then change the statute to resolve it. I really think that that is what's going on here. And I think if we follow the appellant's argument to the end, we find that although this statute is very inclusive, very broad, has no limitations, no qualifying words, I think what is happening is that appellant is saying that nothing is covered. I believe I heard him say that no torts would be covered, that the employer would be immune for all torts. I think what this is an attempt on the part of the legislature to put public employees and public employers in the same position vis-a-vis their relationship with each other as private employees and private employers. And, you know, if there's a workers' comp case and the plaintiff was compensated and the court is thinking about whether to apply the immunity or not in terms of whether the compensated employee can sue, that is another question. That's not the question that is raised by this case.
Counsel, since you referenced the legislature enacting the statute, it was designed, of course, to partially restore sovereign immunity, common law sovereign immunity, which was abrogated by this court. Do you know in your research, did you discover what how the situation would have been covered under the common law immunity prior to the statute? Because that might have some bearing on what the legislature intended to do.
Well, you know,
if you don't, that's fine, yeah. Because that's sort of in the past, but it might have some bearing on what this means.
Well, obviously, at one time, you know, the queen was immune from everything, and the government decided to abrogate that immunity so that its citizens would have the right to sue it. The immunity statute holds. It has many exceptions and many defenses. This is clearly an exception that the legislature intended. I just don't know how else these words can be read. I've read them over and over, and I don't see that there is any ambiguity. I don't see how else they can be read. And I have to say that I think what appellant is asking is for the court to have a per se rule that eliminates all torts, prevents employees from suing for any tort. And I think their backup position is to say, well, okay, so maybe they can sue for certain kinds of negligent torts, but they can't sue for any tort that smacks of intentional. And by the way, the tort of negligent misidentification is exactly that. In Wigfall versus Society National Bank, 1985, it was held that this tort exists so that persons who are negligently improperly identified for being responsible for a violation of law can sue. It requires a duty to that person, a breach of the duty, proximate cause, and an injury. That is a tort of negligence. That is not, as appellant would like to characterize it, a false arrest tort. I think there is only one issue here. The issue is whether or not Mr. Sampson's allegations arose from his employment relation. The question is not what are the allegations. The question is, did these matters arise out of his employment relation? It's very clear that they did. It's very clear that this statute needs no construing. It's very clear that, in fact, the legislature didn't want it to be construed. Therefore, Mr. Sampson asked the court to find very simply that 274409B operates to permit his lawsuit to go forward, and ask the court to remand this case for trial. We are, again, I have to emphasize, asking to make a rule for Mr. Sampson. This case does not involve whether Brady et al. Would or would not apply. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Funk, you've used up all of your time. In fact, almost 5 minutes over your time. You can have 30 seconds to sum up.
May I just ask if you're asking that all torts, that we're covering all torts or just intentional torts in your argument?
Okay, Your Honor, let me answer her question, then I'll sum up. We're asking for, one, intentional torts, by definition, do not arise out of the employment relationship. That's essentially reaffirming the rule that was announced in Blankenship, but also been followed by a majority of the appellate courts that have interpreted it. And secondly, we're asking, with respect to other types of common law tort claims, that they have to be based upon or created by the employment relationship, as opposed to an injury like, for example, the injuries that have been alleged in this case, which arise out of an arrest and conduct that's not based upon the employment relationship. And when we talk about importing workers' compensation law into the immunity statute, in 2744.09, the General Assembly is the one that's importing language arising out of the employment relationship from the workers' compensation case law. 2744.09C is importing language from the public employees' collective bargaining law, chapter 4117, and 2744.09E is importing language relating to violations of the constitutions and statutes of the United States. So the General Assembly is the one that is relying upon the body of case law that defines what arises out of the employment relationship when they adopt 2744.09B. And that is an exception to the rule of immunity. So as an exception, it needs to be strictly construed. So what they're asking to do is for the court to disregard the body of case law that defines what arises out of the employment relationship and adopt a broader, more a broader conception of that rule that would open the door to a whole set of intentional tort claims that political subdivisions have long been immune from. And we ask really that the court reaffirm the rule that has long followed in Ohio and hold that political subdivisions are not the insurers of intentional tort claims.
Counsel, do you know how long that rule was followed? Was it followed at common law immunity?
I did think about your question, and I don't know that I did fully research that, but I do think that if you look at, for example, the immunity rules that govern state employees, there is a same conception that that there can be negligence claims brought against the state under certain defined, that's in 2743 is the state immunity. But that when it comes to intentional conduct, you can't sue the state for intentional conduct. That's only if you can fit within the fabric that will allow you to sue an individual employee, assuming that you can meet the test that would allow for that. I think that's long been the common law understanding of immunity, that there's not a lot of precedent that would say that political subdivisions can be held liable for intentional torts.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We will take the matter under advisement, and you will be notified of our decision. Thank you very much.